Marva Hinton, and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Phil Latzman is away on some much-needed vacation. Our weekly mission is to keep South Floridians informed on local and regional news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. This week they are David Lyons, the editor-in-chief of the Daily Business Review. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Jim DeFede, a former newspaper man, now an investigative reporter for WFOR-TV, CBS4. Welcome, Jim.
Hello, Marva.
And Mary Ellen Kloss, the Miami Herald Capital Bureau Chief, who's joining us from Tallahassee. Thanks so much for being with us, Mary Ellen.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
Well, we're going to start off today with talking about the economy. New jobless numbers came out this morning. Unemployment continued to drop last month, hitting 7.7% in Florida in February. The state unemployment agency reported that this morning. Now, this is a drop from 9% last year. Nationwide, unemployment in February dropped in 22 states. Florida's unemployment rate is on par with the nation's, also at 7.7%. President Obama is in Miami today. In just a few hours, he's going to be speaking at Port Miami about the economy and the need for public-private partnerships to make infrastructure improvements across the country. Just yesterday, Governor Rick Scott held a conference call with reporters where he blasted the president, saying he was late to the party when it comes to investing in our ports to create jobs.
We've done way better than they have. Look at the 4 years before I became governor. The state lost 800-some thousand jobs. Unemployment tripled. By making these smart investments, what's happened in our state? We've had almost 300,000 private sector jobs, the second biggest drop in unemployment. So we're doing the right things here. They need to do the right thing.
Now, for Governor Scott, doing the right thing means the federal government needs to reimburse the state for the money spent on our ports in order to create jobs. So, David, do you think that the governor has a point with that?
Well, $77 million is a small change when you look at the size of this project. It's a multi-billion dollar project that was envisioned about 5 years ago after the Panama Canal widening project started. And the idea is to allow bigger ships and therefore more commerce into places like the Port of Miami. I believe Port Everglades and the Jacksonville port upstate are also in the mix for money and for deep dredging and widening their respective facilities. So this is a man who never saw a federal dollar that he didn't like until he moved his position away from the Tea Party. And now suddenly, federal money is needed to, help buttress these public sector projects. And he's absolutely right. But it's taken him about 4 years to come to the party, I think, in my opinion. The president, when he first took office, had $787 billion worth of incentive money, and practically every GOP governor across the United States rejected that money. Scott rejected about upwards of $3 billion for a high-speed railroad program in Florida. And it's certainly on program for public private sector projects to take hold, because the more resources, the better. And to have both sectors cooperating is much better than having just the government participate or for a private enterprise to undertake the entire burden. So, in a way, I think yesterday's exercise was a bit superfluous, grandstanding of 24 hours ahead of the president coming. The president has had 4-5 years worth of discussion about using public infrastructure as a method for increasing or having being the leading edge for the economic recovery in the wake of the 2008 crash. And it's nice to see both the governor and the president are more or less on the same page now when it comes to public money for building infrastructure projects like this.
Well, you did. You touched on this, David, that there was a point when the governor, he was not wanting any funds at all from the federal government, and now he's complaining that the president hasn't done enough to support infrastructure improvements to the Port of Miami. So is that a valid argument that he's being a hypocrite here, Jim?
Well, it's called election season. It's called trying to win re-election. And what's fascinating to me about the governor's sound isn't even this debate over a piddling $75 million. I mean, that's nothing. And the hypocrisy is evident from what David was explaining. But you see Governor Scott's reelection strategy pretty clear in it, which is when I came in, we lost 800,000 jobs. Now that I've been governor for the past almost four years, that look at how the state has rebounded, as if what happened in Washington with the stimulus and all the other programs that Washington was doing had no effect. So Scott is in this very interesting position of needing to take credit for the lowering unemployment rate, but at the same time criticizing Washington for not having done anything about it. So he needs to try to find that sweet spot. And it's going to be a tricky walk. And so far, you know, that's the thing that makes Scott, you know, why you can't write Scott off. Even with his bad poll numbers, even with all the problems that he has, you know, a decrease in the unemployment rate, if it continues to decline, he gets to make the argument, why would you want to change to a new governor? Why would you want to change course? We're heading in the right direction. That's his best argument. Unfortunately, voters don't seem to be answering much to it.
Well, he did go ahead and put out his first campaign ad for this new election season earlier this week on Facebook. It's called First Time. It touts his record when it comes to job creation. He mentions how in January the state's unemployment rate dropped at that point to 7.8%, and that was the first time that it's been below the national average in 5 years.
Since our policies went into effect of lower taxes, less regulation, a positive business attitude, private companies in our state have generated over 282,000 jobs. It's working. We will be the number one place where families can get jobs. We're not going to stop until every family that wants a job in the state has a job.
The ad also goes into how bad things were before he was in office. It sort of seems to be taking a dig there at former Governor Charlie Crist. And it features employees from a business in Orlando who say the governor has made all the difference. They're doing all kinds of hiring now. And so the let's get to work that we heard for his last campaign, that's gone. And the new tagline is it's working. So, David, is it working?
Well, I'm happy for the people who are getting new jobs in Orlando. But I think that Governor Scott is in a similar position of 40-some-on other governors in the United States. The national economy has been recovering very gradually as the banks, as the financial system regained its footing. You know, new regulations have been put into place, and new foreign investment has been coming into the United States, particularly here in Florida, which in South Florida, I believe, is principally responsible for a rebound in housing, real estate, construction. Swire Properties, for example, from Asia, has a very big project in the Brickell Financial District that's coming out of the ground. I think there are many, many other dynamics that have contributed to the economic comeback. I mean, clearly, you know, the governor is in a position where he should be using the bully pulpit to promote Florida. He's been doing that. But I think that what we just heard is significantly overstated.
Well, Mary Ellen, do you think this new campaign tagline, it's working, is that going to play out very well politically?
You know, the presumption that the governor has used in all his ads and now in his this new tactic, which is obviously a precursor to his campaign, is that he was going to create additional jobs. But the economist, when he came into office, predicted that the number of jobs that we have created are pretty much the ones that were created. So the question is, did the governor do this, or as David suggested, are other factors at play here? Will it convince Floridians that he should get another term? It's really early to tell. And I think that he has to continue to show people that he is engaged in a little bit more than just the rhetoric of the job pieces. I think people are looking to see him show accomplishment in other areas, and that's why we're also seeing a big pitch from him focusing on education and jobs for teachers or pay raises for teachers and improvements in the higher ed system.
Well, despite those things, Mariella, you know, he did come out and says he wants to give raises to all teachers. He does seem to be making some changes and reaching out to groups that maybe he alienated in the past. But still, the poll numbers just aren't very good for him. I mean, the latest Quinnipiac poll shows that he would lose to former Governor Charlie Crist. Also shows that he would lose to Democrat Alex Sink, the woman he defeated back in 2010. Jim, how reliable do you think that this poll is as an indicator of people voting in November?
Well, it's very, very early, as Mary Ellen said, and polls, you know, as we learned, there's some good polls and there's some bad polls, and we don't usually know which ones are the good ones and which ones are the bad ones till after Election Day. but look, I think the problem that Rick Scott has had is connecting in a personal way with voters. He's always come across as a little bit different. And I think that's been his biggest problem is having that personal sort of touch. That's why Charlie Crist is such a scary opponent in that way, because Charlie Crist is all charisma and personal appeal and you know, shaking hands and making that connection. It's where Rick Scott is the weakest. You know, can Rick Scott, with his vast fortune and fundraising ability, overcome that? Yeah, good media strategy often has a sort of appeal. But again, I think, you know, as Mary Ellen said, you know, the two prongs to his approach are going to be, I created lots of jobs, as I promised, and I made higher education affordable. Whether or not he ends up getting the $2,500 raise for teachers, Mary Ellen probably has a better feel for that, whether or not the legislature is likely to give him that raise. But at least he gets to say he tried.
Right. And remember, we want everyone who's listening to remember, this is your show, too. You can call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Or you can email us at thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. Again, that's thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN or go to WLRN.org to participate in our live blog. The online discussion is hosted by our producer, Elaine Chen. Now we're going to take a break. I'm Marva Hinton, and for the vacationing Phil Latzman, welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Our guest today, Mary Ellen Kloss, the Miami Herald Capital Bureau Chief, who's joining us from Tallahassee, Jim DeFede, an investigative reporter with CBS4, and David Lyons, the editor-in-chief of the Daily Business Review. Your questions are welcome for our panel. You can email us with the first name and location to thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. You can call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. I'm Marva A. Hinton. That's my Twitter handle, at Marva A. Hinton. Feel free to send me a tweet as well. We also have our live blog where you can join us for an online discussion hosted by our producer, Elaine Chen. You can find that discussion on our Facebook page and on our website, WLRN.org. This segment, we really want to dig into what's going on in Tallahassee with Mary Ellen. We're about halfway through the state legislative session now. And in terms of what's been accomplished and the issues that are getting attention, has it been pretty much what you would have expected?
Well, it has been an interesting session. I really think that after the very contentious previous 2 years, where it was very partisan, we had redistricting fights, this presidential election that was weighing, overshadowing everything. We really have a session this year that is much less partisan than I've seen in a long time, and some of the issues that are emerging are issues that they're actually finding some moderate positions, and both sides are kind of supporting. We've seen issues that have been contentious for years getting resolved. One little turf battle that emerges every single year is the fight over whether or not to let optometrists be able to prescribe oral medications, and they've always fought with the medical doctors who are ophthalmologists, and that issue is getting resolved. There are other things that really look like things have moderated, and that's been, I think, one of the themes.
What about some tough issues that you see where there might be more contentious fighting over in the legislature?
Well, we have seen that there is a two stakes being pitched on things like pension reform. We've got the House, which wants to push through this proposal that would basically eliminate the traditional pensions for all state workers and many local government workers, and allow any, require any new employees to then join a 401k style plan. That would have a huge immediate impact on the state budget, but in the long term, they say would save money. The Senate is not willing to do that. They are looking at a little more of a hybrid thing that would allow workers to voluntarily pull out of the traditional pension plan and new workers to voluntarily sign up for the 401k plan. And so that's looking like that will be a little bit of a fight. We also are going to have some budget differences, but you mentioned the governor's proposal for a pay raise. I think that is one issue that all sides are seeming to get behind. It's just how the pay raise is going to look. Pay raise for both teachers, and now the House has come out with a pay raise for all state workers.
Well, when you were talking about that pension issue, that's something that the Florida Education Association came out and they were talking about that on Thursday there in Tallahassee. The Florida Education Association Vice President Joanne McCall said that the House plan, the one that would do away with the 401k, is a real problem for teachers who tend to be women.
Women live longer and need to plan for a longer retirement. That makes the protections of the defined benefit plan more valuable than any of the proposals being bandied about in the legislature.
House Speaker Will Weatherford, he says if something isn't done about our state's pension plan, that it could easily go bankrupt. Mary Ellen, can you just give us some context into that? I mean, how much does the state pay for employee pensions?
Well, this debate all turns on the question of who's going to hold the risk. Right now, the state pays 97% of an employee's pension contribution. And if you're a new employee, you get a choice of going into the traditional plan or signing up for already you have a choice to sign up for a 401k plan. If you're in the traditional plan, no matter what the stock market does, the state government will guarantee that when you retire, you'll get a fixed payment. If you're in the 401k plan, like many of us in the private sector are, you are in control of that pot of money. And no matter what the stock market does, you're going to suffer the consequences. There is no guarantee that that money will be the way you expected it, you know, the amount you expected it to be. So that's the argument of teachers, for example, that they would like to have the guarantee that the pension will be a fixed amount and that the risk will be held by the state and not by employees. There's a lot of people that feel that when employees are given access, especially those in the that are lower income, they often tap their pension funds before they retire. And if the state holds it, there is that protection that people can't touch it.
Well, David, isn't this the way we sort of see business going this, you know, these days? Pensions are a thing of the past, it seems, for most
businesses. In fact, most companies are trying to steer themselves away from the defined pension plan because, in fact, many U.S. Corporations that continue to manage them, their plans are underfunded, and it's a very difficult time for many corporations that you know, have had to go through the ups and downs of the economic cycle, and you know, they just don't have the money to continue to contribute. So, I mean, many years ago, 3 decades ago, the 401k plan came into vogue. Knight Ridder, the former parent of the Miami Herald, started its plan back in the mid-80s. McClatchy, the subsequent, the successor of Knight Ridder, continues to maintain a defined pension plan. I know because I'm vested in it, and I guess it was with mixed feelings that the Miami Herald building was sold for $235 million because on the one hand, you hate to see the building go, but on the other, McClatchy announced that a lot of that money was going to go to help fund the pension plan that they have in place right now. But there's, you know, the 401k plan is the principal vehicle for retirement these days. It has been for a long time, and I think the public sector is trying to move fairly quickly over to that methodology, mainly because, as Mary Ellen pointed out, there are savings to be had. Naturally, a lot of people who have been relying on pension plans, there's a decision-making process that they don't have to be involved in. They rely on financial professionals to make the investments, and it's a significant responsibility. I mean, one of the downsides of the 401ks has been that people have made the wrong decisions. They've invested in stocks that were too high, and then they went down, and it's a major responsibility on the part of an individual, and many of them don't have the expertise, and I think that's a psychological setback for a lot of investors. They just don't want to have that burden of having to find a way to make their 401ks grow.
Jim, is this something you see that's the way of the future for the state?
Well, I just want to know, will I be able to continue to invest in bong shops? Will the legislature do away with the can we still buy bongs in Florida or not? And texting and driving. Once we get into retirement plans, I'm getting older, but I'm more interested in whether or not I can my local head shop is going to disappear. Mary Ellen, any help with me on that?
The texting while driving and the bong shop bills are definitely high-profile issues this session.
Are they going to pass?
Well, the texting while driving bill actually is gotten farther along than we've seen it in many years. And I think because they have it as a secondary enforcement, which means that if you're going to get stopped, you're going to get stopped for something other than texting, then that is sort of the cover they're going to use to maybe let this pass this year.
That and the fact that Ellen Bogdanoff did not win re-election. I think that's a big help.
That's right.
Well, Mary Ellen, you were saying it looks like the texting while driving might be a little watered down. That's the same thing people are saying about ethics reform. What have you been seeing with the Senate and the House as far as the bills concerning that?
Well, it looks as though the House and Senate both are kind of barreling ahead with these two bills that they are they're calling the most significant ethics reform in decades. But as we've watched the ethics bill and an accompanying bill relating to campaign finance, they've kind of slowly been diluted. And now we have bills that are really much more watered down than the original provisions. For example, the House bill, which has a ban on any legislator who retires can't turn around and come right back the next year and lobby as a lobbyist of the executive branch. And that includes all the state agencies, the billions of dollars of contracts that are held by private companies. Often they want to hire lobbyists to help push their business through. Well, the House decided that rather than ban all legislators, we'll just ban the presiding officers because they have the most control. So we've got that dilution. And then we've also got some changes to the campaign finance bills where they originally were going to say we're going to eliminate all political committees called CCEs and then allow all the money to be steered through political committees that are controlled by candidates. But in return, we're going to give them this increased disclosure requirement. So the last 10 days of the campaign, they have to give instantaneous online reporting of all their campaign contributions. Well, that provision has been whittled down. So we've seen other things emerge. We've got a new provision that allows for legislators to create blind trust so that if they don't want to disclose all their finances, they will create a blind trust to hide them. So as things are moving forward, we're realizing that when the rubber meets the road, it's really hard for them to try and impose new rules on their own ethical behavior.
Mary Ellen, can you explain to us what a CCE is?
Okay, that's called a Committee of Continuous Existence. It's one of those political committees that has all these high-minded names like Committee to Protect Liberty or Committee to Pursue the Future of Education. And basically, they have been used as just fundraising machines. Legislators have been able to take as much money from unlimited amounts of campaign checks, collect the money, and although they are not allowed to use it on direct campaigns, they can steer the money into other campaign accounts so that they have now become these slush funds. Legislators have also used them to pay for travel, pay for entertainment, meals. It has been highly abused by many legislators because the law has got a giant loophole and it lets that happen. So they're closing these CCEs and are putting the money or allowing the all contributions now to go to political committees, and political committees will have no cap in the House plan, at least, as far as how much they can collect. And some are saying it's really a distinction without a difference.
Well, Jim, are you at all surprised that it seems like real ethics reform is not going to happen? We're just going to get these watered-down bills.
You'll get bills that they can take credit for because they'll have good-sounding names. But and campaign money, you know, the way I always try to think of campaign money is if you think about a concrete sidewalk with a lot of cracks in it, those cracks are those little loopholes that Marianne was talking about. And legislators will go and try to put you know, putty up those cracks. But when you pour water on concrete, water has a way of just sort of finding new cracks, finding new ways to sort of seep into the surface. And as much as you may want to try to cover over some of those cracks, you know, the water will find the new cracks to sort of seep down into. And that's the way political money generally is. Political money will always find a way to get to where it wants to go.
Well, another big issue this week has been education policy in Tallahassee. There was a rally held by supporters of a bill that would allow parents to step in and exert some control over their child's failing school. Supporters call this a parent empowerment bill. Republican State Rep. Carlos Trujillo of Miami is the bill's sponsor.
So your choice today is to have the parents have a seat at the table and what's in the best interest of their child. The parents, the ones who are responsible for them, not the teachers, not some community activists, not some not-for-profit, the parents.
And opponents like Jeff Wright of the Florida Education Association call it a parent trigger bill.
This bill does not empower parents. It empowers out-of-state corporate interests and their lobbyists to siphon Florida tax dollars away from our already underfunded public school system.
Mary Ellen, we've heard what both sides say about this. Can you just explain what the bill is? What does it do?
Well, it basically allows parents, when they're in a district that has a school that gets an F on the state's report card for two straight years, to petition a school district to say, we want to see a change here. We want a turnaround plan. So they sign a petition and try and get some changes. Now, the proponents of the bill say that only 25 of the thousands of schools in Florida that drew failing grades would ever apply, would ever be eligible for this. And they think that the parents have a right in those districts to, as they say, have a legal seat at the table. Now, the opponents say that this is really just an opportunity for the charter school industry or private entities to come in and encourage parents to collect these petitions and move in to replace the existing school system with a charter school. And they see it as kind of a wolf in sheep's clothing.
Well, where is the bill now? How does it stand?
Well, it is moving in the House. As you heard, Representative Trujillo has been one of the biggest proponents of this. And it looks as though they will likely get something through this year. The Senate, because of the election, has a new dynamic. And I think that in the end, it may just be watered down a lot more before they get it through. But it's one of those issues that seems to be moving mostly in the House. There is increased support in the Senate this time around. And the proponents have made changes to the way it looked last year to make it not as draconian for school districts.
Well,
and
Mary,
the governor is supportive of it. So,
okay. Well, Mary Ellen, we have a caller on, Andrew in Fort Lauderdale. He wants to ask about the possibility of internet cafes being banned. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us on the Florida Roundup.
Hi, thank you very much. I was calling in because there's been a lot of movement and on these on the banning of these internet cafes. I understand the House has voted to ban the legality of these cafes. The Senate is now it's gone through committee in the Senate. It was supposed to be fast tracked for the Senate, but it hasn't been. And I understand the governor hasn't committed one way or another. So I was wondering what your panel thought about the issue.
Mary Ellen, what can you tell us about that?
Well, the he's right. The House has passed a bill and moved very quickly. The Senate has one committee stop for it, and then it will go to the floor. I think that they are going to do what they have resisted doing for many years, and that is clarify the law and basically say that these machines that have been operating are illegal. Now, the impetus for this is, of course, the federal and state investigation that began out of Seminole County, in which they arrested about 57 owners and operatives of an internet cafe chain that were operated by Allied Veterans of the World. And this group portrayed themselves as a charitable organization, but in fact only gave about 2% of their profits to charity. And that became the impetus for this crackdown. And I think that embarrassment and the fact that the legislature has received, I think, upwards of about $2 million in contributions from this industry has given them a little bit of a black eye, and they're now rushing headlong to eliminate these machines. The issue that will affect South Florida the most is how are they going to define the machines, and that's where things are slowing down a bit in the Senate. They're actually talking about defining adult arcades as games. You know, the question is, are those going to be defined, the games used in those places, which are a little bit different than the ones that are used in the internet cafes in the rural and northern parts of the state, are they going to be considered games of skill or games of chance? And the law enforcement says they're all games of chance and they're all illegal. But there's others who are trying to persuade the Senate and the governor that there should be kind of a carve-out for them.
Well, that is something we will definitely be watching in the second half of the session. You are listening to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Marva Hinton. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm sitting in for the vacationing Phil Latzman. Our guest today, Jim DeFede, investigative reporter with CBS4, David Lyons, the editor-in-chief of the Daily Business Review, and Mary Ellen Kloss, the Miami Herald Capital Bureau chief, who is joining us from Tallahassee. This past week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in two cases involving same-sex marriage. One of those looked at Proposition 8 in California, which banned gay marriage in the state after it had been legal there. The other dealt with the 1996 Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. The case centers around whether or not Congress can withhold federal benefits from same-sex couples who are married in those states where it is legal. Can the government treat legally married heterosexual couples differently than gay couples? Now, gay rights advocates here in South Florida, of course, were watching that court action very closely this week. Matt Laszlo, our reporter in Washington for WLRN, he happened to run into a gay couple from Fort Lauderdale who came to Washington to stand outside the Supreme Court this past week in support of same-sex marriage. In 2009, Andy McNeil and his partner, Todd Bloodworth, traveled to Vermont to get married. Bloodworth says they've had a lot of obstacles to overcome.
Regrettably, our marriage is not recognized in our home state of Florida, providing many potential obstacles personally, emotionally, and financially for our family.
Voters in Florida supported an amendment, Amendment 2, to the state constitution back in 2008, which banned gay marriage in the state. Now, David, based on what the justices said at the arguments, do you think the court will take action that would strike down Florida's ban and make gay marriage legal all over the country?
I think it's very difficult to tell at this point because the justices are more concerned about jurisdiction at this point than they are about the underlying questions. Both of these cases, the Prop 8 case and the U.S. versus Windsor, Windsor's Edith Windsor, a woman in New York City whose partner died a couple of years ago. She was left a large inheritance. And essentially, this is an inheritance tax case because the marriage was not recognized with her partner. The marriage took place in Canada. They migrated to New York City. Her partner died. Edith Windsor took, I guess she was hit with a $360,000 tax bill, and she has to pay it because you know the union with her deceased partner was not recognized by the state. So the overall question that the court is concerned with is whether or not there is damage here. Edith Windsor won her case at the U.S. Second Court, Circuit Court of Appeals, but the Obama administration, seeking a definition of marriage, appealed that decision, and I think that caused a lot of consternation for mainly the conservative justices on the court, principally John Roberts, who criticized the White House for bringing the case to the court in the first place. I think Roberts told the government lawyer that why don't you just not defend the law and not enforce the law? And both these cases, I don't think. The court is very comfortable with having to deal with it all. So it's entirely plausible that Anthony Kennedy, for example, who's regarded as a swing vote on the court, raised several questions as to why this should not be a state question. It's a federalist question. These types of questions should be decided on the state level, and it's entirely possible that the court, seeing how because of the way the both these cases arrived in Washington, it's there are strong questions that they brought to the table about who was damaged and who actually has standing here. Because even in the California case, a federal court judge threw out Prop 8, and it wasn't the state of California that appealed to the Supreme Court. It's a group of private citizens that appealed to the to the Supreme Court. So the question in that case is, well, who's damaged? Whose interest is being offended here outside of some philosophical objection that they have with the Prop 8 being prohibition being thrown out.
Right, and we're expecting a ruling on that sometime this summer from the court, June or July.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim, what about on the state level? Do you think there's the political will to have gay marriage become legal here in the state of Florida?
I don't know how that would play out. The polling that I've seen done in Florida suggests that there's some sort of hybrid that the Floridians support. Republicans still overwhelmingly oppose gay marriage, but support civil unions, which is a move for their part. Democrats are now more likely to support gay marriage. But here's the thing. Between the Supreme Court and all these things that we're talking about, whether or not the Supreme Court issues a sweeping edict on this or not, or whether it's an incremental thing, in 10 years, we're not going to be talking about this. I mean, it's almost the trajectory of this is absolutely clear. The movement from the politicians to the public opinion to everything is moving to the point where gay marriage is going to become commonplace throughout the United States. We won't be talking about this issue. In fact, the way we'll be talking about this issue is in civil rights terms about how long it took to resolve. But the finish line is easily at hand. Conservatives are already acknowledging that. Rush Limbaugh was acknowledging that on the radio. Sean Hannity, others, they all seem to be sort of acknowledging that they've lost this debate and that it's just now a matter of filling in those last small vestiges. But I think the court is just going to take its incremental time and we'll sort of see. And, you know, it's never a good thing when the public has to vote on other people's civil rights, and that's where the court ultimately will play its role.
Mm-hmm.
And as you mentioned, we do see so many people who are saying that their feelings have changed on this issue. One of the holdouts we've seen, though, is one of our senators, our Senator Bill Nelson, our Democratic senator, he came out this week and said he still believes, you know, marriage should be, you know, one man, one woman. Do you think that's going to hurt him at all politically, Jim?
Well, he just won re-election. My theory is that he has taken that position in part because I think Bill Nelson is thinking of jumping in the governor's race. If he does, he doesn't want that issue around his neck. Because he sort of still reads the polls in Florida. He doesn't maybe think that Florida is there yet. And so I think that he's maintaining his stance on gay marriage to protect and preserve his ability to jump into the governor's race should he decide to do that against Rick Scott. If he doesn't get into the governor's race, I would expect to see Bill Nelson starting to soften his position on gay marriage as he gets into this term here.
What are you hearing, Mary Ellen, in Tallahassee? Are state lawmakers talking about this at all?
No, not at all. And it's part of the reason is that this is, you know, they're pushing things in the House, for example, that would limit abortion. We've got three bills moving over there that the Senate president says it's not going to happen. We already have a constitutional amendment in Florida that bans gay marriage. I don't think that the dynamics are going to change anytime soon. Obviously, if the U.S. Supreme Court says that these constitutional amendments are a violation of federal civil rights law, that will start a new discussion in Florida. But right now, it's not happening.
Well, we also had a few responses from our Public Insight Network on this topic. I want to get those in. Robert Burr from Coral Gables, he wrote in and told us, "I've changed my views over time on gay issues. The balance between what makes me uncomfortable or my personal preferences versus a person's right to fair treatment under the law has tilted in favor of fairness over preference." Obviously, that's going to be a big issue, and it's one we'll be hearing about as this the days go on. And again, we should get rulings from the Supreme Court this summer. Another big issue for us this week has been the Miami Dolphins. We're going to talk about them now. The Dolphins are offering to repay Miami-Dade and the state of Florida most of the taxpayer dollars the team is looking for to overhaul Sun Life Stadium. The team is also promising to stay in Florida for 30 years and to bring at least one Super Bowl by 2017, with four Super Bowls total over three decades. Now, the catch is that this public money the team wants, $167 million, would be repaid in 30 years without any interest. Representative Eric Frezen, a Miami Republican and the House sponsor of the bill that would allow them to get some money from some tax revenue, says that he hopes the concessions will satisfy opponents.
To those who have been opposed to the bill in good faith regarding the details of the bill, I think this should assuage or at least accommodate most of those concerns.
Well, is he right, Jim? Are these concessions enough?
Well, public sentiment is still really hot on the issue of public dollars in any way going towards billionaires for sports stadiums. It's in part a hangover from the Miami Marlins and that stadium deal. You have to give the Dolphins credit. They have certainly been masterful in maneuvering and working on this issue. You know, every step they've taken, they've tried to seem as if they're accommodating their critics. I keep coming back to one basic, everything from if we don't get 50 or 51, Super Bowls 50 or 51, we'll give the county a chance to opt out, we'll pay for the election. Every step they take seems to, you know, try to ameliorate the concerns of opponents or make their opponents seem small. I just keep thinking to myself, why go through this hassle? Why, Stephen Ross is worth $4.4 billion. I don't understand why he doesn't just finance it himself and be a hero that way. I actually more and more am thinking that there's a certain ego involved on the part of the Dolphins that sort of says they want to win this fight. They want that sales tax rebate, that $3 million a year sales tax rebate, because every other sports franchise in the state got it. And the fact that whether they need it or not, the fact that they're not getting it, I think, angers them. And I think that they just want to win. I think if they had this sort of competitive winning drive in their football team, we'd be bringing some Super Bowls home, you know. But this is, I actually think that this is now more about winning this fight than financing the stadium, because they're offering to pay it all back over time anyway. But you know, Stephen Ross could do it if he wanted to, write the check.
Mary Ellen, what are state lawmakers saying about this now?
Well, this is going to be one of those bills that, if it moves at all, it will. Well, it's moving, and it's, you know, moving through the committees, and I think they're giving the proponents of this a lot of airtime. But it's going to likely be so loved to death that it's so loved it will be loved to death. And the reason I say that is that in the House they're saying, well, if Miami will get this stadium, then we've got to give one to Jacksonville, and we've got to give a tax break to the Daytona Beach Speedway, and we need to give some benefits to the sports teams in Tampa. So they're piling on all these other little gifts to other areas of the state, and they'll ultimately, I think, want to see these all wrapped together. And in that case, it will die, because it will be portrayed as corporate welfare, and it won't go anywhere. So I think that Jim is right. This has been masterfully managed, and it's been a textbook case of how to absolutely lobby the legislature. I'm still not sure they're going to succeed.
Jim, do you think that David, do you think that this deal makes financial sense for the Miami-Dade County and for the state of Florida?
Well, these are all one-time events. I mean, clearly the port deal is a much better deal than the stadium deal, because at least they're going to have continuous 52-week-a-year economic activity running through the Port of Miami and Port Everglades and the port up in Jacksonville. But what do you have? You have a 1 or 2 weeks run up to the Super Bowl and a one-time splash. Yes, there's economic impact during that particular time. But what do you do with the stadium for the rest of the time, other than the regular season and concerts and whatnot? I guess it's nice to, you know, for to have some rock and roll under a roof during the times that the Super Bowl is not there. My email is continuously filled by messages from the Dolphins PR machine that another hotel, another small business, another business alliance, they're all on board because they foresee an economic impact. But my mind keeps going back to economic impact analyses by economists all around the country who take stock of the stadiums in the respective areas, and they do not see a continuous positive economic impact with relation to the cost that the communities have to undertake to maintain these places. And another thing that troubles me is that these stadiums, they seem to be Edsels. They seem to be obsolete. They're built, and then 8 or 10 years later, suddenly they're no longer prime venues or suitable venues to have a Super Bowl or an All-Star game or whatever. And it just seems to be rather disingenuous on the part of these large private sector operators who have to come back to the public time and again for some sort of an upgrade in order for an enterprise like theirs to stay in town. I think there are a lot of other things that we can be doing with this public money, particularly funneling toward the education system, which needs to be upgraded.
Well, guys, we are about out of time here, but I just wanted to give each of you an opportunity to tell listeners how they can get in touch with you, if they should go through a website, if you want them to contact you on Twitter. Jim, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
I am all about the Twitter now. I'm a Twitter over Twitter. I am at Defeedy, DEFEDE. You could also reach me, email jdefeedy@cbs.com. That would be fine and lovely if you did.
Okay, Mary Ellen, what about you?
You can reach me on Twitter as well, and it's Mary Ellen Kloss. That's KLAS.
Okay, David?
Email dlions@alm.com.
David is old school. He won't get into that Twitter thing yet.
And I love the Twitter, too. You can reach me on Twitter at Marva A. Hinton. Okay, well, again, guys, thanks so much for joining us today.
Prayers for Phil, because I know he's in rehab, right?
On vacation.
Same thing. Okay.
That's the story. Vacation.
Too many town hall meetings.
Okay, now that's going to do it for the Florida Roundup for Friday, March 29th, 2013. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. or online at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Alicia Zuckerman. Elaine Chin is our associate producer. Our Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Ferrero. Our executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. For WLRN Miami Herald News, it's Dan Gretsch. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next. Until next week, I'm Marva Hinton, and for Phil Latzman, and stay informed, South Florida.